distrust upon the crust of the world. It is thin. Moles are at work beneath us. They have tunneled the subsoil with separate chambers.
You are listening to the voice of Edna St. Vincent Millay reading a poem from her book, Huntsman, What Quarry? A page from this afternoon's edition of Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Each Sunday at 3, WNBC, in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YW and YMHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings from poets past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. Our guests today, Deems Taylor, and by transcription, Edna St. Vincent Millay. April 26th, Harper and Brothers will publish Mine the Harvest, a selection from the last poems of Edna St. Vincent Millay, poems which she, at the time of her death in 1950, was preparing for publication, together with a few unpublished poems from an earlier period. This afternoon, we'd like to sketch briefly for you the life of this brilliant and widely read American poet, who's been described as a master of human expression and a spokesman for the human spirit. Later in the program, the distinguished author and composer Deems Taylor will tell us of his friendship with Miss Millay and read some of his favorite poems from the new collection. Edna St. Vincent Millay was born in Rockland, Maine, and grew up in the coastal towns of Maine and Massachusetts. As a child, she wrote for St. Nicholas Magazine. At 19, her first poem, Renaissance, was published and brought her immediate recognition. Over 200 lines long, the poem opens with an almost childlike simplicity and rhythm. All I could see from where I stood was three long mountains and a wood. I turned and looked another way, and saw three islands in a bay. With an extraordinary beauty, the poem builds gradually towards a climax of exaltation, deeply felt in the final two lines. God, I can push the grass apart and lay my finger on thy heart. Miss Millay's first book of collected poems appeared in 1917, the year of her graduation from Vassar College. 5 years later, in 1922, she was awarded the Pulitzer Prize as America's Outstanding Poetess. From college, Edna Millay came to New York City, where she acted with the Provincetown Players and the Theater Guild. Writing continuously, she began public readings of her works, which she continued until her health failed her in 1939. Through the very kind assistance of Marvin Camp of WNBC's Special Events Department, we were able to locate recordings of a broadcast which Miss Millay made in October of that year. The occasion was the 9th Annual Forum on Current Problems under the auspices of the New York Herald Tribune. Miss Millay, addressing the audience on the subject, The Challenge of Civilization, speaks with a poetic but firm conviction on the first of our four freedoms.
In this country, where freedom of speech is poured so generously into the parched throats of aliens and of naturalized aliens, among whom, as we know, are many whose first allegiance still is to the land of their birth, not to this land, and whose chief concern is to discredit and pull apart, not to support and strengthen our form of government. There is danger today that the good average American citizen, fearful of making some indiscreet remark and of helping thus to get his country into war, will become completely tongue-tied. That would be a pity. That silence would make room for a serious and extremely voluble menace to our democracy. Because the more pledged and devoted to a totalitarian system of government a man is, the more unscrupulous he will be in his dealing with any other system. This is his pride and his honor. From which it follows that the two most undesirable citizens in any democracy today are the most loyal and idealistic communists and the most loyal and idealistic fascists. These two people may be good people, kind neighbors, intelligent and charming companions, yet they must, in accordance with their own ethics, take advantage of our every indecision to trouble and confuse us further in order to hasten as much as possible that sacred day when, moving up quietly from behind, they may strike us down for good.
Miss Millay concluded her speech with a reading from her book, Huntsman What Quarry. She chose the poem Underground System. And although 15 years have elapsed since that occasion, a terrifying truth can still be found in the words she wrote and spoke.
Set the foot down with distrust upon the crust of the world. It is thin. Moles are at work beneath us. They have tunneled the subsoil with separate chambers, which at an appointed knock could be as one, could intersect and interlock. We walk on the skin of life. No toil of rake or hoe, no lime, no phosphate, no rotation of crops, no irrigation of the land will coax the limp and flattened grain to stand on that bad day, or feed to strength the nibbled roots of our nation. Ease has demoralized us, nearly so. We know nothing of the rigors of winter. The house has a roof against, the car a top against the snow. All will be well, we say. It is a habit, like the rising of the sun, for our country to prosper. Who can prevail against us? No one. The house has a roof, but the boards of its floor are rotting. And hall upon hall, the moles have built their palace beneath us. We have not far to fall.
Ha! After a period of living abroad, Edna St. Vincent Millay met and married Eugen Jan Boissevain. When not at Steepletop, their farm in New York State, or Ragged Island off the coast of Maine, they traveled or lived in New York City. At the time of her death in 1950, Edna St. Vincent Millay was assembling material for a new book of poems, her first since 1940. The final work of collecting the poems and deciding which of alternative versions should be used has been carried out by the poet's sister, Norma Millay. We couldn't think of anyone better fitted to tell us not only about Mind the Harvest, but also about the poetess herself, and a man who was a close friend of hers over a long period of years, and with whom she wrote The King's Henchman in 1927. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Deems Taylor.
I first met Edna Millay in Paris more than 30 years ago. She was small, wiry, tense, almost morbidly shy. She had green eyes set in a pointed, faintly freckled face that might have belonged to a leprechaun, and topped by a wealth of tawny blonde hair cut in a boyish bob. She was very vain of that hair and wore it in that same bob all her life. And that life, for her, was poetry. Her attitude toward her own work was a combination of great pride and equally great humility. I once asked her how it felt to be a great poet. Well, she said, I think I'm pretty good, but not yet good enough. She was extremely generous in her attitude toward her contemporaries. I've never heard her make a derogatory remark concerning the work of any other living poet. Of her own work, she was ruthlessly self-critical. She would agonize, literally for days, over a single imperfect line. This meticulous workmanship, as well as her precarious health, accounts for the comparatively restricted bulk of her output. Even so, in a writing career of 34 years, she turned out 6 plays, an opera libretto, and 11 volumes containing about 500 poems, including upwards of 170 sonnets. And that list doesn't include any of the poems in this new volume. On one occasion, I had the luck to be able to work with her. In 1925, the Metropolitan Opera Company commissioned me to write an opera, leaving the choice of librettist and story up to me. Well, thinking that I might as well start at the top and work down, I approached Edna Millay with no hope whatsoever. To my stunned surprise, she agreed to give me a libretto. Her final choice was a story out of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which she called The King's Henchman. At least that was our working title until we could find a better one. We never did. Incidentally, The King's Henchman is probably the only opera that was ever written by correspondence. Vincent, her friends call her Vincent rather than Edna, was subject to recurrent blinding attacks of migraine headache. And so dreading to face a season in New York, she spent most of the year 1926 on her farm in the Berkshires, working when she was able and sending me the text in installments. As fast as one installment would arrive, I'd set it to music, and then wait for the next one. By a minor miracle, our joint and separate efforts managed to make grammatical and musical sense. Any discussion of Edna Millay's career must inevitably involve mention of the man who so profoundly influenced her career, her husband, Eugen Jan Boissevain. He was a prosperous coffee importer when they were married in 1923, who promptly sold out his business and devoted his life, literally, to furthering her career. In the year that they were married, they bought a 900-acre farm in the Berkshires, which they called Steepletop, and where they made their headquarters as long as they both lived. Eugen was convinced that he had a genius on his hands and saw to it the genius had room to expand. Her job was to write poetry. His, to keep the world at bay, to manage the farm, to discourage all visitors except a few intimates, to attend to her correspondence, to act as cook and housekeeper when servants were hard to find. In short, to constitute himself a wall behind which she could work undisturbed. And it wasn't all work. I've never known two people who got more fun out of just being alive. Eugen's death in 1949 left her stunned. They took her to a hospital in New York to recover from the shock. Many of her friends and relatives begged her not to go back to the farm, or at least to go with a companion. But she refused. I must be at Steepletop, she told me. That's the only place where I can get used to his not being there. She arranged to have the telephone at Steepletop take only outgoing calls. If the phone should ring, she said, I'd hear the sound of his feet running to answer it. At the time of his death, she was working over some of the poems that are being published in this book. I must be alone to work on this collection. He made me start it, she said, and I must finish it. That's what he'd want me to do. And so for the greater part of a year, she remained at Steepletop in solitude, except for a resident farmer and his wife, working on her poems. On the night of October 19th, 1950, as on so many nights, she sat in the living room at Steepletop at work. Sometime during the night, she must have called it a day, so to speak, and started up to bed. Late the following afternoon, the farmer noticed that the lights were still on in the main house. He made his way in and found her body huddled at the foot of the stairs. The task that her husband had laid upon her was nearing completion. The end, if not yet reached, was at least in sight. It was almost as if she had hurried to tell him so. You know, reading this book is almost like having Vincent back again. All her old qualities are in these poems, her exquisite use of words, her wide-ranging imagination, her deep philosophy, her occasional pessimism. I'd like to read you a few of them, if I may. Here's a very simple one about the mother that she adored. The courage that my mother had went with her and is with her still. Rock from New England quarried, now granite in a granite hill. The golden brooch my mother wore, she left behind for me to wear. I have no thing I treasure more, yet it is something I could spare. Oh, if instead she'd left for me the thing she took into the grave, that courage like a rock, which she has no more need of, and I have. And here's one concerning man's refusal to dare the unknown. Amorphous is the mind. Its quality is in its fiber, not its form. If it desire to fly, it puts on wings, awkwardly, not like a bird at first, though later. The rustle of a thing half heard can twist it as iron at times is twisted by a windstorm, or word after word can pummel it for hours, yet leave it, like a leaf on a still day, unstirred. But a man's habit clings, and he will wear tomorrow what today he wears. The mind is happy in the air, happy to be up there with learning feathers, but the man loathes it. The mind cries, up, oh, up, oh, let me try to fly. Look, I can lift you. But he smothers its cry. Out of thrift and fear of next year's feathers, he clothes it in last year's things and tries his best to button across a keel-shaped breast a coat knobbed about by new wings. Many of these last poems have no titles. However, this one she does call An Ancient Gesture. I thought as I wiped my eyes on the corner of my apron, Penelope did this too. And more than once. You can't keep weaving all day and undoing it all through the night. Your arms get tired and the back of your neck gets tight. And along toward morning, when you think it will never be light, and your husband has been gone, and you don't know where, for years, suddenly you burst into tears. There is simply nothing else to do. And I thought, as I wiped my eyes on the corner of my apron, this is an ancient gesture, authentic, antique, in the very best tradition, classic, Greek. Ulysses did this too, but only as a gesture which implied to the assembled throng that he was much too moved to speak. He learned it from Penelope. Penelope, who really cried. The thought of impending death began to haunt some of her last poems. Here's the opening stanza of a longish one that she called Journal. This book, when I am dead, will be a little faint perfume of me. People who knew me well will say, she really used to think that way. I do not write it to survive my mortal self, but being alive and full of curious thoughts today, it pleases me somehow to say, this book, when I am dead, will be a little faint perfume of me. This one's called Steepletop, where we find Vincent scolding her flower garden for needing so much attention. Even you, sweet basil, even you, lemon verbena, must exert yourselves now and somewhat harden against untimely frost. I have hovered you and covered you and kept going smudges until I'm close to worn out. Now you go about it. I have other things to do. Writing poetry, for instance. And I, too, live in this garden. Nothing could stand all this rain. The lilacs were drowned, browned, before I'd even smelled them, cool against my cheek, held down a little by my hand. Pain is seldom preventable, but is presentable even to strangers on a train. But what the rain does to the lilacs is something you must sigh and try to explain. Borage, forage for bees and for those who love blue. Why must you, having only been transplanted from where you were not wanted, either by the bee or by me, from under the sage, engage in this self-destruction? I was tender about your slender taproot. I thought you would send out shoot after shoot of thick, cucumber-smelling, hairy leaves. But why anybody believes anything, I do not know. I thought I could trust you. Here's one of my favorites. Vincent had great sympathy and compassion for all living creatures. Burns wrote a poem to a mouse. She goes a step farther and writes one to a dying snake. Poor dying thing, it was my dog, not I, that did for you. I gave you a wide arc and moved to pass. And yet I was not sad that you should die. You jarred me so. You were too motionless and sudden, coiled there in the grass. Now you are coiled no longer. Now your splendid streaked back is to the ground. Your beautiful light scarlet blood is spattered and shines in dreadful dewdrops all around. And that white ugly belly you had not confessed, so naked, so unscrolled with patterns, is at last exposed. Oh, I do not like to see a fellow mortal's final agony. We shared this world all summer until now. Now, off you go. All upside down you lie, less looped than flung, and all but done for. And yet, with head still raised, and that red flickering tongue. One of the most striking and rather terrifying flights of her extraordinary imagination is this poem, which has no title, but concerns another living creature. Intense and terrible, I think, must be the loneliness of infants. Look at all the teddy bears clasped in slumber in slatted cribs, painted pale blue or pink, and all the Easter bunnies, dirty and disreputable, that deface the white pillow, and the sterile, immaculate, sunny, turning pleasantly in space, dainty abode of baby. Try to replace them with new ones, come Easter again, fluffy and white, and with a different smell. Release with gentle force from the horrified embrace that hugs until the stitches give and the stuffing shows, his only link with a life of his own, the only thing he really knows. Try to sneak it out of sight, if you wish to hear anger yell glorious from air-filled lungs through a throat unthrottled by what the neighbors will say. If you wish to witness a human countenance contorted and convulsed and crumpled by helpless grief and despair, then stand beside the slatted crib and say, "There, there," and take the toy away. Pink and pale blue look well in a nursery, and for the most part, baby is really good. He gurgles, he whimpers, he tries to get his toe to his mouth. He slobbers his food dreamily, cereals and vegetable juices, onto his bib. He behaves as he should. But do not for a moment believe that he has forgotten blackness, nor the deep, easy swell, nor his thwarted design to remain forever there, nor the crimson betrayal of his birth into a yellow glare. The pictures painted on the inner eyelids of infants just before they sleep are not in pastel. To many people, Edna Millay was the greatest writer of sonnets since John Keats. Certainly any reading of her poetry must include at least one of them. Here is one that might well be her last will and testament. If I die solvent, die, that is to say, in full possession of my critical mind, not having cast to keep the wolves at bay in this dark wood till all be flung behind, wit, courage, honor, pride, oblivion of the red eyeball and the yellow tooth, nor sweat, nor howl, nor break into a run when loping death's upon me in hot sooth. 'Twill be that in my honored hands I bear what's under no condition to be spilled till my blood spills and hardens in the air. An earthen grail, a humble vessel filled to its low brim with water from that brink where Shakespeare, Keats, and Chaucer learned to drink.
Thank you very much, Deems Taylor. Rather than use our own words to close this afternoon's program, we've chosen Miss Millay's words on a subject which echoes back to her first published poem, Renaissance. Speaking of man's faith in his God on an NBC radio broadcast in 1943, Edna St. Vincent Millay said,
"Our grandfathers, our great-grandfathers, our sires of different nationalities who founded this country, those of them who wrote our Constitution were deeply religious people. We live today in what is predominantly a Christian country. We call ourselves Christians. Are you a Christian? Do you call yourself that? Then you know what to do to please your great prophet, Christ. You know the kind of person to be to make him feel less sad. Be then the kind of person of whom he could be proud. Do then the things which would please him."
And so, Anthology, number 8. Our thanks to Deems Taylor for being our guest, to Marvin Camp for his assistance in preparing this afternoon's memorial to Edna St. Vincent Millay, and to Harper and Brothers for allowing us the pre-publication rights to her latest book, Mine the Harvest, which will be on sale tomorrow. Next week, an Englishman and an American write of England. A poem by Rupert Brooke, and as our featured work, Lynn Fontaine reads, in its entirety, Alice Dewar Miller's dramatic narrative, The White Cliffs of Dover. Anthology is brought to you by WNBC in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YW and YMHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan. John Malcolm Brennan, director. Anthology is produced by Steve White, written and directed for WNBC by Draper Lewis. Until next Sunday at 3, this is Fleetwood wishing you good luck and good reading.